Good morning. Welcome to StratCom Live, the podcast for the strategic communications insights that help our small businesses and small nonprofits to achieve big market results. My name is Kelsey Bowden. I am the president and founder of Grand River Agency, and this podcast is brought to you by Grand River Agency. It's certainly competitive out there, whether you're trying to stand out in digital marketing or to secure the much needed funding for your nonprofit mission. So we are committed to helping you find success with limited resources. And speaking of which, our guest here today has literally written the book on doing more with limited resources, or several books, I should say, on doing more with limited resources. So this is an absolute treat. Our guest today is the nonprofit fundraising guru, Joanne Oppel. She has a lot of acronyms and abbreviations after her name, which we'll get into here in a little bit. But Joanne is a very, very good friend of mine and a colleague and one of the world's foremost experts in nonprofit management and fundraising. So, Joanne, thank you for being here. How are you doing today?
Oh, thank you for having me. I feel good.
You feel good? Okay, so you're on the east coast of Florida, correct?
I am.
Okay, so you just missed out on the hurricane. Like, did you?
We got
get any weather from that?
Yeah, we got some weather, but we lost power for 30 seconds. You know, not much.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm happy that you're safe, and certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to the others affected in Florida.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm happy that you're safe and you're able to join us today. So Joanne is also one of our digital marketing clients. She just signed on with us for Joanne Oppel Consulting. Tell us a little bit about your consulting business first, and we'll get into a little bit more of the background.
So right now, currently, I am a faculty member at the National Development Institute. And sit on conferences and have meetings, and I serve as a senior consultant to Development Systems International. Mm. And what we do is we specialize in major gifts. So I have gone from starting as a program development manager and grant writer to development director to assistant executive director to executive director, where I was at first influencing department and then influencing a whole agency. And now as a consultant, I get to influence the field in multiple agencies. So it's been a growth track for me, and I love it. I love what I do.
That's fantastic. That is awesome. We usually start in this podcast with, if it's just me and Josh, we start with some fun questions to ask ourselves. So I'm just going to ask you some fun questions, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. What was your favorite vacation that you've ever taken?
My favorite vacation.
I wasn't going to give you these questions in advance, so you didn't get to prepare.
My favorite vacation is always the most recent vacation I've taken.
Okay.
Because it's top of mind. But number two, all the vacations are good. And most recently, like last weekend, we went to Lake Okeechobee in southern Florida.
Nice.
And visited a Seminole reservation and the Atatiki Indian Museum at the Seminole Reservation down in the Everglades. We also got to see a lot of the ranch lands with a lot of cows and horse mm-hmm. farms, mainly cows. A lot of sugarcane is grown down there as well.
Right.
And then on our way home, we went to the Kissimmee Prairie Lands State Park, where we saw a herd of deer. We're greeted by going into the park on this long dirt road for 4 miles. By a herd of deer crossing the road and a buck about 100, 150 feet away from us, just looking at us from the brush saying, are you going to move or am I going to move?
That's how it goes. Absolutely. What are, okay, this is just way, way out in left field here, because we're not here to talk about deer, but I'm up here in Western New York. We're, you know, pretty far away from each other. The deer up here are pretty big. What are the deer like down there?
They're pretty small.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay.
They're not as big as they were in New Jersey.
Because mm-hmm. like you'll see, for the most part, you see a lot of like does.
Yeah, you know, a lot of does.
Like by the roadways and by the highways and everything like that. And I mean, they're big. But I mean, if you ever see a buck somewhere, that thing is huge.
No, it's not a huge. These were not huge animals. Part of it is all the scrub that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, it's prairie land. It's not rich, lush forest that they're able to forage food on. It's
right.
Little stuff. What surprised me when I moved here 3 years ago is how much ranch land there is. Texas has more ranches, ranch land in terms of geography, mm-hmm. but we have more ranches in terms of number. That Florida has more ranches than Texas in terms of the number of ranches that we have.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And meat is high price here. It's the highest priced meat I've had anywhere in the United States that I've lived, because they have this little scrub brush that these animals feed on. None of it is really healthy food.
Right. So. Yeah. Oh, I get that. So, all right. So your favorite vacation is always the one that you took last, which makes sense. That's awesome. That's a really cool way to look at things. You know, my favorite vacation that I've taken, I mean, I've had my, you know, trips down to Florida because I have family down there myself. And I mean, each one stands out for, you know, a different reason, something different that we did, or a family member who was able to be there. Or, you know, like last year when I went down with my daughter, Talia, that was the first time that I was able to bring her down there to see my family in Florida. So that stands out. But there are other ones that stand out, like, you know, when I went to the Virgin Islands for spring break when I was in college. You know, that one stands out because it was just a really, really fun time and we were kids, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, that's I'm glad that your favorite is the most recent. That's a really cool way of looking at it. I have one more interesting question for you, and it is, speaking of food, you were just mentioning deer eating food. What is your least favorite food that you could still eat if you absolutely had to?
Actually, there is a food that I absolutely hate, Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
However, we took a trip this summer to Charleston, South Carolina, and we're in this soul food restaurant, you know, a local yokel soul food restaurant, and they mm-hmm. serve fried Brussels sprouts with garlic and Parmesan cheese, and they were delicious. So even though I hate Brussels sprouts, and I do with a passion, I love them fried with garlic on them.
I'm so glad that you're actually able to answer that question, because I figured when I was thinking of it, I'm like, is that going to be a thinker for her? You know, like, because I don't know that anyone really ever thinks about that. Like, yeah, I guess I really don't like carrots or whatever, but I would eat them if I had to. You know what I mean? In me, I'm so I love all foods. Like, there's really nothing that I wouldn't eat or wouldn't enjoy. So I don't even know that I would be able to answer that question for myself. Yeah. Either way, I mean, again, these questions are just fun things to break the ice. They're neither here nor there, but we like to ask them just to make it fun here. So let's get into it here, if you don't mind. So Joanne, you spent more than 30 years, your career spanned more than 30 years in the nonprofit realm, working in a variety of roles, but most notably, you know, as a nonprofit executive and executive director. It was several different organizations that you were executive director of, correct?
No, just one. I was
just the one. Okay.
Just an executive director at one and an executive director at another. It was a suicide prevention agency.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about your experience there, just specifically as an executive director, just some quick thoughts.
Well, I came into the agency and it was financially failing. it probably had a lot of the typical problems nonprofits, small nonprofits without large budgets do with cash flow problems. So the board was blissfully unaware of how bad things were. The staff was blissfully unaware of the changes that needed to be made. And I was looking at 2 weeks worth of cash flow and then we would be out of money.
Can I back you up there real quick? You said the board was blissfully unaware. And I mean, I feel that it's common for sometimes, I mean, like, and we always thank our, you know, nonprofit board members for in many cases, volunteering and giving their time to, you know, advancing a nonprofit mission that they, you know, that is close to their heart and they're really committed to it. But I find it very interesting that board members would be that out of touch to be blissfully unaware of the financial realities facing their organization. How is that even possible? I mean, like, they're looking at the same numbers that you are.
So number one, boards are traditionally, unless you have a CPA or a accountant on board, don't understand the financials. A lot of them don't understand the financials, number one. Number two, a lot of them don't understand the proper role of boards. They like to get into the day-to-day management rather than evaluating the CEO or the executive director in terms of two things, financial impact, program impact. The only two things that they do, and then they should sit in an advisory role. Legally, they have a fiduciary responsibility for the nonprofit to the IRS. They have to fulfill that role. But in that case, what had happened was the audit were prepared the year before I came. The executive director was very beloved and very trusted and decided not to bring the auditor in to the board meeting to explain the finances, and also had not shown the board the management letter that the auditor had written in terms of the poor documentation and the record keeping. So the board had no idea. They just thought they had a great relationship with this previous executive director who was very, very charming, very likable, very, you know, but administratively, from my point of view, inheriting the mess, it was a nightmare. And the board just didn't know about it.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. Okay, so continue on there. You're there. The board is blissfully unaware. The staff is blissfully unaware, and you're able to turn around this organization. What were some steps that you took to get there?
So the first thing that became clear is that I was staff heavy. I was not going to be able to keep all the staff, and probably the hardest thing I've had to do in my whole nonprofit career is lay off somebody. Not because of any performance issues, but because the money was just not there to pay them. That was very difficult. And I had to do that within my first month.
That's a tough adjustment. Yeah. Correct.
So I didn't start off on the right foot. I wasn't the beloved soul because I immediately came and cut staff. The second thing was it became apparent that going through the first year season, that the organization's funding sources, grants and special events, were not working for them. That even though these were beloved events, and even though they had relied on when the cash came in for cash flow for these events, each year they were making less and less and spending more and more time on it. And the return on investment was just terrible. Mm-hmm. And once I accounted for all the indirect costs, not the just the direct costs of what, you know, the venue, the menu, the speakers, whatever it was, the decor, whatever it was you have for the gala that they were holding every year. Once I put in labor costs in there, it was actually losing money. And
that's very common too. Yeah.
That is extremely common because
so many nonprofits out there, they are just married to the annual fundraising gala that they don't even realize is actually losing them money when there's so many other nonprofit fundraising tactics that they could be investing in that actually would bring them more bang for their buck. But it's not. We've always had this gala. Why would we not have
right.
this?
That's right. That's right. So in the 5 years that I was there, what I did was I moved them out of special events and into major gifts. Mm-hmm. The transition was very, very difficult because of the things that you have just mentioned. I had board members leave. I had volunteers leave. I had people say that I was destroying the agency. It was not a pleasant. So what I learned was that change management is very hard in a skill. And if you're going to make drastic changes like that, you're probably not going to last very long because either you're there as a turnaround expert 3 to 5 years, and then you can make an adjustment to a different skill set, or you get burned out and you need to move on to something else because you don't have the skill set to make the car go on an even keel. You're used to this up and down, up and down, up and down. My specialty is growth and growth management, resource development, program development. That's all of that stuff. So I prefer to work in a somewhat challenging environment where there are issues that have to be overcome. The more challenging the issues, the better for me personally, which is why I like consulting so much, because people come to a consultant when they have issues. They're either not making enough money, or their board is not engaged, or they're the best kept secret in their community, which are all very common issues that I come across. And for each nonprofit, depending on its mix of culture and funding sources, it's a challenge to get there. But I prefer to come in and go out over a long period of time to address issues rather than keeping them on a stable keel. So that's why I left. There was nothing wrong with the nonprofit. And in fact, I've kept in touch with the leadership at the nonprofit that I did that for. And they recently were able, while I was there, they increased their assets tenfold and they doubled their agency revenues. Since then, they've like 5 times their agency revenues, and they've been able to double the bank, the endowment again in terms of opening different accounts at different banks or wealth institutions, so that they have a broader representation in the community and have different financial advisors to lean on for managing their major gifts. So that's a real win, because I was there from 2011 to 2016. So it's been 7-8 years since I've been there. And it's very, very gratifying to see that growth and the kind of growth that major gifts can do, which is why I wrote my most recent book, Reimagining Major Gifts, because I didn't know about Major Gifts Ramp Up at the time, but I was doing the background work. I wasn't applying necessarily the system that Jimmy LaRose prescribes, but I was following the principles, and I saw firsthand how moving from a grant and special events based funding based and moving it over to major gifts really changes the whole sustainability and the whole future of the organization.
So you and I are now both associated with Nano Major Gifts Ramp Up. You mentioned that you have just authored the Reimagining Major Gifts, which is one in a series of books that are coming out from there. Lewis Fawcett has Reimagining Nonprofits. Jimmy LaRose has Reimagining Philanthropy, and I believe there's another version of that coming out here sometime.
Correct.
So there's a series of books that are devoted to nonprofit fundraising, and specifically major gifts and putting your organization in a position to achieve more return on investment for the activities that you're doing to raise money for your mission. Money follows mission. So tell me more about this, this reimagining major gifts. I haven't had a chance to go through that myself at this point. I've been more or less focusing, as I said before, on your other previous book, The ROI Mindset. But tell me more about kind of like the layout of this reimagining major gifts book.
So the ROI Mindset talks about the mindset to have. It talks about really adopting return on investment as your efficiency measure and how to measure that in terms of input versus output. Less input equals more output is basically what you're looking for. Less time and effort, less money, less resources to go into something that will give you more money and leverage your time so you can have a life. But so many nonprofit executive directors don't have a life. They work 60 to 80 hours a week constantly.
My cat just came in. I had to open my door. I saw that. Continue.
They get burned out. They get stressed out. They get divorced. Well, you know, whatever they end up doing, they don't take vacation. And that really does need to change because they deserve a life. And they just have to get paid well as well. And the only way to do that is to move to a system where you are spending less time raising more money.
Right.
Leveraging your time and effort. So that's the premise of the ROI mindset. What Major Gifts Ramp Up does is it takes that mindset that I describe in the ROI mindset and it puts it into a systemized system, basically, a systemized suggestion in terms of how to do that through Major Gifts. The ROI mindset alludes to the fact that major gifts fundraising is the greatest return on your investment. And it tells you how to achieve that in terms of board engagement and staff engagement, volunteer engagement, servant leadership, abundance versus the abundance mindset. You know, there's a bunch of things, taking care of yourself, managing change. Whereas Major Gifts Ramp Up or the Reimagining Major Gifts talks specifically about the Major Gifts Ramp Up model and how it is specifically applied to nonprofits to not only give you the greatest return on investment, but give you a specific itinerary to follow as you go through your journey in raising major gifts.
Okay. So, and then before that, for Reimagining Major Gifts and before the ROI mindset was the sustainable high ROI fundraising system, which is basically, I have that here. I don't have the physical copy of the ROI mindset. I have the digital copy of it. I'm sure in post-production, we can splash it up there so everyone can see it. But the sustainable high ROI fundraising system, as I see it, is kind of a primer into building that fundraising mechanism, and then the ROI mindset and then reimagining major gifts are the next steps building upon that, correct?
It just gets more and more detailed as you go along. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a natural progression of information sharing on your part that allows it. And it's the way that I love the way you write these things, because there's actual examples of scenarios that nonprofit executives, including yourself, have encountered over the years. So there's kind of like this, here, we're going to frame this issue that was facing this nonprofit, and here's how this issue is overcome. I really like, and it's done in such a way that's very easy for pretty much anyone to understand. I think I had said to you a couple of weeks ago when we were texting, like, my dad read the sustainable high ROI fundraising system, and he's just a retired cop. He's just interested in it, but it's very nice the way that they're written that way. And I mean, your audience for these books, I mean, they're educated people, but it's still written in such a way that it would be interesting and engaging for pretty much anyone that would be interested in that. Maybe even someone who's just looking to start a nonprofit for themselves because they care about an issue. So
I would
is that is that why you were you, they were they're written in such a way that's so easy to understand?
Well, I'm a good writer. I'm not.
you're fantastic, right?
Writing for a long time. I wrote the book to executive directors and to other nonprofit fundraising leadership. They could be board members. They could be directors of development. They could be VPs of development. Mm-hmm. Also the nonprofit professional who one day aspires to be an executive director or a CEO of a nonprofit.
Right.
So very specifically, I was writing to an audience. They tend to be on the educated side. They tend to have executive directors tend to have master's degrees or some level of experience is equivalent to that. Mm-hmm. And they tend to live in the more urban and suburban areas as opposed to rural areas, just like the regular population of the United States. But a lot of it came from my experience as an executive director in terms of the things that I was doing. I was in the finances every day. Every day I was in the finances. What's coming in? What's going out? What's my cash flow like? What's my return on investment this month? And a lot of nonprofit executive directors that I was surrounded by didn't do that. They were more concerned with how many people they were serving that day or that week or that month. They're filling out the reports, or the human resource issue that came up. And even though I was concerned about that, my primary focus was the finances and bringing in the revenues. Part of that was the situation I was finding myself in. But what I found out was that because I had that emphasis, not a lot of other people did. They didn't understand the mindset that I was coming in with, that business, entrepreneurial, you have to run this like a business type of thing first.
And the enterprise mindset. Yeah.
The enterprise mindset so that you can then garner the resources to meet the mission that you want to meet and you can scale an impact. And that fits well with when I was introduced to Nano, which I loved Nano because it was all about organizational capacity building. When I met Nano, and that's the level I came in on, is I was thrilled that some other organization had the same and entrepreneurial mindset that I did. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had found home. And then I was introduced to Major Gifts Ramp Up. It was just such a natural fit because, again, I went from, you know, the system I had developed, which was not too different than, at least in theory, from the system that had been around for 30 years that I knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. And so we got into an arrangement and hitched our wagons together. And for the last year, it's been great.
You and Jimmy?
Me and Jimmy.
Oh, we love Jimmy the Lord. Okay, so NATO is, for those who don't know, is the National Association of Nonprofit Organizations and Executives. Another one of our digital marketing clients, that's how we're associated with that. And thank you, Joanne, for making that connection, by the way. But I think I recall you saying something the other day about your first encounter with Jimmy LaRose, the founder of that philosophy there. How did that first encounter go?
Well, I had found Nano. And I left Nano, and I wanted letters after my name, and I wasn't too thrilled with all that. I knew that I could go for my certification for fundraising executives that the Association for Fundraising Professionals offered, but I knew that would take me about a year's worth of study and a little bit more experience in terms of some of the methods that And I didn't want to be methods based. I wanted to be capacity building based. So I found Nano and they had all these certifications. And I thought, great, I'm going to go get letters after my name. And I.
Yeah. And you have the trifecta now.
And I have all three certifications.
Yeah. Certified nonprofit executive, certified development consultant. And what was the third one?
Certified Development Executive.
CDE, Certified Development Executive. So you have all three of those now. So yeah, you do have the letters after your name. I knew we were going to get into that at some point.
But what that did was it got me into the research behind what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Dr. Kathleen Robinson and Jimmy had done a longitudinal study and surveyed a number of nonprofits to find out what works. And I was just fascinated by this research, and that there was empirical evidence behind it. And I'm a pretty data-driven, analytical person. I was just in heaven with all this data. Oh, great.
Yeah.
And I know I'm a nerd that way.
That's okay. The most successful people are.
But I had just written the high ROI fundraising system. And I thought, I'm going to call Nano because their research and my system align very closely together. And I talked to Lisa Van Zyl, the membership director, and I said, I would like to offer my book at a discount to Nano members. And she says, well, you'll have to talk to, or she says, well, let me arrange a meeting with you. Well, about an hour later, Jimmy LaRose is on the phone saying, I understand you have a book that you want to, and was talking to me all about Major Gifts Ramp Up. And that's how we met.
That's fantastic. So before I go any further, because I know Josh would kill me if I didn't mention this, for anyone who is looking for some digital marketing expertise or even some grant writing for your small nonprofit, visit us at grandriver.agency or grandriveragency.io. You can fill out the contact form. We're always checking it. We're always happy to have the conversation. Follow us on social media, and we'll include some links in the description here. But like I said, Josh would probably kill me if I didn't put that out there. And I'm his boss.
And your specialty, you should probably say your specialty is the small nonprofit. Those under.
That is our niche market. Absolutely. The small nonprofits trying to help smaller nonprofit organizations that typically would not have the budget to afford hiring a full-time marketing director or hiring even a part-time person to do grant writing. A lot of them do the small nonprofits. They tackle grant writing by committee, or if they have some sort of public relations, community outreach, or just even social media, they also do that by committee, whoever is available or whoever might have that skill set. Which often ends up not being as fruitful an endeavor as bringing on somebody with a little bit of expertise to handle those tasks. And we tend to do that on a contract basis. So, yeah, thank you for reminding me of that, Joanne.
I recommend your approach. I just believe in your approach so much that if you take a little bit of investment, you're going to into something that's worth it. You're going to realize far greater returns than if you take a small investments and kind of pitter patter around with it.
That's exactly it.
And you really don't go anywhere because of a host of issues, which I'm not going to get into right now, but I really do believe in getting an expert involved when you need expert advice.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, and I'm trying to be, as I'm describing those problems, knowing that that's our target audience and that's who's listening to and viewing this podcast, I'm trying to be as diplomatic about the issues as possible, because I mean, I don't want to come across as condemning leadership or organizations, how they're run. I know that that's a lot of them are operating the best way that they know how. And sometimes that's putting things together kind of piecemeal and doing the best that you possibly can. It's, throwing digital marketing tasks to somebody who really doesn't know how to accomplish those things. So it's nice to have that expertise, kind of at your beck and call, which is what we try to do. Exactly. And we very much appreciate that. So anyway, away from our promo here, I wanted to kind of dive into your latest books, The ROI Mindset, How to Raise More Money with the Budget You Have, and the Reimagining Major Gifts, which is kind of the same messaging, just again, building upon the sustainable high ROI fundraising system. I wanted to talk about a couple topics in particular where one of them being like working with your whole team, your board, your staff, your volunteers, when raising money, like it really is a team effort. It is like, you know, it takes a village. So in several, chapter 5 of the ROI mindset delves into that. And I'm sure obviously the Reimagining Major Gifts does as well. So how do you kind of foster that culture of collaboration within a nonprofit organization?
Yeah, a lot has been written about this and studied a lot of it in terms of a servant leadership, in terms of the mindset that you have. I tend to think, and I know Stephen Covey came out with the theories way back when about the scarcity mindset and the abundance mindset, but it really, really, really starts with, do you believe that there's not enough resources around and that you're competing for resources and that you're going to have to claw over everybody to get what you need to fulfill your mission? Or do you believe that there's enough out there? You're just looking in the wrong place and you need to take what's out there. It's yours for the taking. And it starts with your mindset. It starts with, how do I come out of that scarcity mindset? Please help me. I need help. To that abundance mindset of, we're going to succeed. Do you want to come on board with us? And then it goes into a concept that has, again, been written about by hundreds of authors and researchers in terms of servant leadership, in terms of delegating things that you need to delegate while still maintaining responsibility and accountability for everything that goes on in your organization. Part of that goes to how your board is structured. Again, it's more addressed in Reimagining Major Gifts, where a board then needs to get out of the operations. And so many times, I'd say 99% of the time, I see boards involved in operations, either because the CEO or the executive director needs help, or because neither party knows what the real role is. And there really is not a unified approach in the industry as a whole to board CEO relations. They kind of all figure it out on their own, which is, again, why I like the nano philosophy and the National Development Institute research backs us up in terms of boards having an advisory role and making sure that the exec and hiring and firing and evaluating the CEO. And that's all they do. They're there to advise in their areas of expertise. There's no more than 5 to 7 of them, because a working group does not work if there's more than 7 people in it.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that, a working group theory. Yep, I completely agree theory, with that.
And it works so much more smoothly when everybody is in their own lane and understands what they do. And I know of a board member who sat on the board of a nonprofit, and she resigned. She says, I am so tired of proving how many paper clips they can buy. She says, I don't want to sit there and look through financial reports that tell me that and have people nitpick about how many paper clips she bought this month. That's not my role. And so many times board members are not engaged because that is expected to be their role. Well, it's not fun to do that. You're not making any meaningful change. It's not meaningful work.
You're just a bean counter at that point.
You're just a bean counter at that point. Or you're planning the gala, or you're reluctantly, you know, trying to sell 10 tickets to fill a table, or do a foursome for a golf tournament, or whatever it is that you're doing. But you lose your enthusiasm when you start getting involved in just making processes happen rather than making outcomes happen and really seeing the outcome of your work. And that goes a lot to how your board is structured and interacts with your CEO or executive director.
Right, right. Another chapter that I went through, it was talking about building a supportive community and inviting donors into your nonprofit family, into your nonprofit mission. It also addresses identifying key stakeholders and creating the messaging that will compel them toward your mission, or maybe help them to see that your values, your nonprofit's values, and their values align, perhaps. So let's talk about, you know, how do we attract those stakeholders? How do we attract those key donors by identifying them and engaging them effectively, and asking them how they imagine philanthropy working, in their sphere. So, how can you be efficient in all of these efforts?
Now, the first thing that you do is you realize that not everybody's going to have an affinity for your mission, and that's fine. You want to bring those people on board who are going to be excited about what you're doing as an organization and bless and release those who have a priority somewhere else. That's fine. Don't waste your time on the three people who never call you back. Look at the seven who do, type of thing. So it starts with messaging. What is your message? What is your unique message and how you form that in terms of how your audience is going to hear it, your donors, your competitors, your community leaders, your funders, yourself? Where do all of those viewpoints and perspectives intersect so that you can have a unique message that goes out to the community? Then you get into branding in terms of making sure that unique message is told or spoken loudly through everything that you do, through your logo, through the colors that you use, through the fonts that you use, the type of photography that you use, to your board minutes, to your board agendas, to your volunteer training manuals, to your staff employment. Just have that message infused everywhere that you have a place to have it, so that it gets ingrained in the people who are already involved in your nonprofit, and they can repeat those messages to those who may be interested in joining you on the path to success. Then, as you narrow down, especially with one thing I like about the Major Gifts Ramp-Up model, is that you have you do have cultivation events. I talk at length about cultivation in the ROI mindset. But you have cultivation activities that draw people into your mission, and they self-select. You can identify them based on, you know, who comes to you, but also who you go to and identify as possibilities. Major Gifts Ramp Up, instead of starting with, we have these people and want to move them up the ladder to giving more, which may or may not happen, which is still important to do in annual giving, but identifying who has the capacity to give and who can we get involved in our mission and who can we get meaningfully engaged so they want to invest in what we're doing and help fund our efforts. And you do that through a series of cultivation activities, starting with an awareness event, which I describe at length in Reimagining Major Gifts.
I love donor scope. As far as identifying potential prospective donors that you likely have not engaged, not even just in your community, but anywhere. Identifying net worth millionaires who may align their priorities and their values and their visions for philanthropy may align with your cause. And without a tool like that to identify those donors, you never would have had a prayer of engaging them, at least in any meaningful way. So as far as a tool like DonorScope, how far do you think that goes in creating that? And as a part of that high ROI fundraising system?
Well, DonorScope itself is not as expensive as most other wealth screening software, number one.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
There's no annual subscription price. And the record, per record fee is like 11 cents. And then you add another penny or two if you want names or if you want phone numbers and emails to go with it, maybe 4 or 5 cents more. But So number one, DonorScope is less expensive. That automatically says ROI. Number two, DonorScope lets you download names as well. And I think it's key. You may have a list of, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 names that you send invitations to your awareness event to, but you design your invitations such that the people who are interested in your cause, you make it interesting to the donor, which is where your research comes in, your branding comes in, and your messaging comes in for all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they come to your awareness event, you take them to the mountaintop in terms of what you're doing and introducing your case for support and what you're doing in the community, what your impact is, what your impact will be, and how you're going to get there, how you're going to increase your impact and expand your efforts. And it works. It works. You get a higher return rate than you do on, say, an annual appeal mailing. You raise much, much, much higher amounts of gifts in terms of dollar amounts than you do in any other form of fundraising. Because even though there's cultivation that may take 6 or 12 months to do, you're realizing 5, 6, 7 figure dollar gifts, $1 million gifts. And that's unheard of in the community. Then in the nonprofit industry, there's a whole lot of consultants who are invested in the processes, the way the methods of raising money. And you'll find a lot of say special event coordinators, for example, or you'll find a lot of annual appeal software, for example, that sort of thing. When in reality, inputting, tracking, and managing the relationships that you have, because there's fewer relationships with bigger dollar amounts, again, saves you lots of time in terms of how many donors you have to care for. You're not talking thousands and thousands of donors anymore. You're talking maybe 100, and that's very doable for a busy CEO or BPF development. And because you're talking hundreds of 5, 6, 7 figure dollar gifts, you have enough now to hire a staff member to say the 5 figure dollar donors, and you're taking care now of the 6 and 7 figure. And you do it again, and you have hire another staff to take care of the 6 figure dollar donors, and so on and so on and so on. And it leads to a real sustainability, financial sustainability. And hopefully what you're doing is, because you're a nonprofit, you're reinvesting your proceeds, your net income, the end of the year back into your missions. You're just scaling your impact.
Right, right. And it's astonishing to me how many nonprofit organizations are out there that are just clamoring to try to get someone to make that $10 donation again. I get it all the time. I get those solicitations because, I give to a number of different organizations that are close to my heart for whatever reason. And I mean, they're usually smaller gifts as I can give over time. And I mean, the amount of effort that a lot of those organizations are putting into continuing to cultivate me, to get me to make that $50 donation again, which is impactful. I mean, like, let's not poo-poo that as, all donations are valuable, obviously, but in terms of something that you're really going to hang your hat on as a fundraising mechanism, that's probably not the route to go, right?
Well, if you have the staff, and I'm working with a nonprofit in Nevada now who has the staff to do both major gifts and annual giving. That's fine. You want many people involved in your organization because you want your brand message to get out there. And as more people who know about it, the better off.
Oh, for sure.
What they've done is they prioritize major gifts. So if you only have one person, or if there's only a CEO, the best way to spend your time, because in an hour you can raise, $10,000, $100,000, $1 million over lunch, provided that you've cultivated the person, which takes just as much time and effort, if not more, to raise $50, $100, $250 through traditional fundraising methods that are more at more arm's length. So I don't think it's a matter of not doing it, like you said. I think it's a matter of prioritizing your time where you're going to receive the greatest dollar. It costs, the industry average, it costs about 10 cents on the dollar to raise a major guest. That's a huge return on investment. Whereas annual gifts are like 30 to 40 cents cost dollar. And I don't blame executive directors who don't know any better, because there's a lot of consultants out there saying, this is the way to do it. This is the way that is traditionally done. Well, one of the things that I liked about the Nano research was they said, those methods don't work anymore. The world has changed. Here's a new way of doing things. And it still holds the same values in terms of making impact and mission and growing that, but it does it from an entrepreneurial financial perspective and applies market-based principles to nonprofits, which is still controversial in a lot of circles.
Yeah, the point that I was making there about the, you know, reaching out to me repeatedly for like to make another $50 donation is the amount of time and resources that they're putting into, you know, reaching out to me when they could really be focusing on this bigger fish, you know? Yeah. So yeah, that's just that they're spending a lot of time and resources where they could be investing in some activities that bring some more ROI. So yeah. Hey, before we go any further, I want to give you a chance to promote where this audience can pick up your books and other educational materials, Joanne.
Self-promotion. This is the part that I'm not good at. I have you.
Just give us a website.
I would go to Amazon, either go to my website, joannearthoutcourses.com.
Yeah, we'll put that in the description.
Or go to amazon.com and type in Joanne Arthout under your search mechanism, and you'll find all my books there.
Right. Okay. Perfect. So one more thing before I let you go. Another thing that you discuss is changing the status quo within organizations. Change is tough. And in addition to being able to accept and enact change yourself as an executive director, or as a nonprofit executive in general, you have to achieve buy-in from stakeholders, from board members, staff members, and sometimes even the community at large. So in your books, you discuss this, and you talk about two different models for implementing change. And can you discuss those models for me?
Yes. One is the quick and dirty model. It's the drastic change, the radical change that has to happen. And that is the method that I had to employ when I became an executive director and found out that there was 2 weeks worth of cash flow. I didn't care what other people thought. This organization was going to survive. And it's ugly and it's tough, and you have to have nerves of steel to get through it because it's controversial, especially with your staff and your volunteers. Your board, however, loves you because you're making the tough decisions that they haven't, and they understand that the survival of the nonprofit is at stake. There's another method, which is a slower, more gradual method, and that is where you make changes incrementally. It takes, 5-10 years to get the full changes in effect. It's not as drastic. You have time to adapt. However, because the change takes such place over such a long period of time, you can lose steam for it. Or people can say, nothing is changing fast enough. This isn't worth it. So there's pros and cons to each method, depending on what situation you find yourself in. What I find, though, in the organizations that I serve is a lot of them have problem, have issues that are affecting them immediately and are affecting their immediate survival. That tends to be when they come to consultants that need some of that drastic change, some of that radical change.
I also wanted just to discuss with you some of your career successes. And you mentioned, turning around the financial situation of the suicide prevention organization the way that you did. Would you count that as your greatest success in your nonprofit career?
In terms of a single thing, yes. One of the things that I love about what I'm doing now is I get to do that for a lot of nonprofits. So in terms of a staff professional zenith, I would say being an executive director, turning it around and seeing the fruits of my labor was a difficult change for the organization to make. And I'm very proud of the fact that I led them through that change and that they're doing so well. Extremely, extremely satisfied over what I was able to accomplish there. But now I'm able to accomplish it on a different level. I work with 3, 4, 5 nonprofits at a time, and we do the same thing. It's not the same sort of, I did it because I'm not the CEO, but it's, I did it in terms of I helped a CEO turn on the light bulb and clean house, and this is how they're doing it now.
Right. Because, you know, I think that in general, we look at, you know, nonprofit executives or executives of even larger organizations as if they don't even need mentorship, you know, that they have achieved some measure of success in their career, that they don't need that. But I mean, everyone, I guess, needs a consultant in one way or another, someone to find the blind spots. Yeah. Things like that. Is that how you look at it?
Yes. Not only to see the blind spots, but to look at the issues objectively. And I talk about this in the Reimagining Major Gifts, is that you have somebody come in who is not part of your culture and who has seen a number of nonprofit cultures as well, who has unique solutions that you may never have thought of or not obvious to you. People who become acclimated to a culture do it very quickly, like within the first 6-9 months of being in an organization. And then they can't see. They're part of the culture. They accept the culture and they don't challenge the norms. That's why when people are new in an organization, it's critical to get immediate feedback and listen to them because they've got that objective viewpoint. Mm-hmm. But so often, especially if you're a stable nonprofit with lots of long-term employees, which is great to have that tenure, you need somebody to come in who can objectively assess your culture and what your blind spots are so that you can move forward and basically change the culture of your organization to become one that functions better.
Right. And not that I would ever want to put you on the spot and be like, what was your greatest career failure? That's sort of, but we all make mistakes and we all do have failures along the way. Now, what, not asking you to identify specifically what that might have been, do you feel that maybe one of the mistakes, one of the bigger maybe oversights that you made along the way was because you weren't able to look at a situation objectively because you were so entrenched in the day-to-day and seeing how your organization operates from the inside for a long time that you weren't able to step out from that and look at it with an unbiased lens?
Actually, my greatest failure is a lot more mundane than that. It's
really
because of record keeping and poor record keeping. I was a development director at the time, had written for a $600,000 grant, had been approved through the funding, and was now working with the government staffer who's the program officer. Well, the rules kept changing, and I kept relaying these changes verbally without writing them down. So that when time came to implement the program, I had nothing in writing that said, this is what you told me to do. And when the program officer came back and said, oh, no, that's not what we want. This is how we're interpreting the rules now. You know, it's like, wait a minute. Does this mean we're not going to get the funding now just because you're changing your mind on how things happen? Mm-hmm. And we lost the funding. And it's, we eventually got it back, but it took a lot of a political capital on the executive director's part to get that back and to make those arguments. But it was a stupid record keeping issue. I just did not keep good records. And from then on, I had, so that a few years later at the same organization when I was an assistant executive director, we had the same thing come up with a different agency that the rules kept changing. In that case, it was because of leadership changes that had happened over a period of years. And so what we were told in the beginning was not what the new leadership wanted. But because we had good record keeping, because I had kept good records, we actually were able to maintain the funding. Even though the new leader wasn't all enthused about it, we were able to finish the grant. So it's those mundane little itty bitty everyday things like record keeping and documentation, just like in HR, that's going to get you or not get you in the long run.
Right, right. Okay, so I think that pretty much does it for this interview. We'd love to have you back to discuss more, perhaps after Reimagining Major Gifts comes out. Of course, I'll be talking to you pretty much every day because we have some important digital marketing stuff to do. Did I get to mention the nonprofit quick guides as well that are available?
You haven't yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have these here. These are fantastic as well. You know, they're little, you know, 45, 50, 60 pagers with, I guess I'll let you describe them a little bit more, with just more or less specific issues that may come up in the day-to-day running of a nonprofit organization. So you can refer to them. They're meant to be read, you know, quickly.
Over lunch or on a plane ride if you're going somewhere or something like that.
Yeah.
They're best read. They're very specific topics. They were written for that. I wrote them. Linda Lysakowski and I wrote them together.
I love Linda.
Linda's great. She is a credit, one of 130 in the world of advanced certified fundraising executive.
Yeah, so I want to get her on here too, for sure.
Can I get
the two of you together? That would be fantastic.
Okay. I think we can handle that.
Sure. Okay, because I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry. Continue. Nonprofit quick guides.
Okay, but they were our years ago, like 20 years ago. Linda had edited some of the first books that I wrote through Charity Channel Press. And when Steve retired from publishing that series anymore, Linda and I decided to co-write because we were finishing each other's sentences. It was like there was one mind 3,000 years apart and a couple generations apart. How does this happen? Wait a minute. Somebody else thinks as weirdly as I do. So we started writing the quick guides, and then we both got involved with Nano and Major Gifts Ramp Up and are glad that we did, and now write for Jimmy.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you, Joanne. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Love being here.
Absolutely. So I think that should do it for this edition of StratCon Live. Of course, again, visit us at grandriver.agency or grandriveragency.io. Of course, you can check out our podcasts here, our blogs, other educational content at stratcom.live. And until next time, we all have a story to tell, so let's tell it well.